title. Yes, I either continue where I left off yesterday. Let me just start by someone raises a question of what do we mean by natural laws and physical laws, and just let me say just a few words about that just to start. So let me just take an example of gravity, right? The law of gravity. What do we mean when we talk about the law of gravity? So when we talk about natural laws and physical laws, it's a sort of shorthand. So I believe that God created the universe and he upholds it moment by moment. I also believe in the law of gravity. So how do you put these things together? So this is a coin, which I'm going to drop in a moment. And I believe that the law of gravity describes the past, right? It tells us people have done experiments dropping coins, and every time they drop them, they fall to the floor. Now, I do not think, because I believe God upholds the universe moment by moment, I do not believe the law of gravity prescribes the future. So when I release this, I don't think it has to fall to the floor. But I must immediately follow that by saying, my expectations are extremely high that it will fall to the floor. And also, because I think God is a consistent God, I believe the law of gravity, which is sort of set up the universe, we've got the law of gravity here, I believe that this is likely to happen in the future, just as it has in the past. So that's my interpretation. We talk about physical laws, it's sort of shorthand, but it's saying you believe that something will happen in the future because God is a consistent God and he operates in a... Okay, one more instant question, yes.
I remember a quote by C.S. Lewis, and he said something like, the natural sciences investigate God's habit.
Right, okay, yes. Yes, right, that's right, or Kepler said... scientists are trying to think God's thoughts after him. You know, the universe and trying to do that. So if I drop this coin, okay, falls to the floor. If it didn't fall to the floor, my immediate conclusion would not be it's a miracle. My immediate thought would be to look on the roof for someone with a magnet, right? Only if you ruled out these things. We should, especially with modern miracles, you know, we should test them all. So that's just an introduction. So I started talking about the resurrection yesterday, and we should first start by saying, can science explain the resurrection? And I think not without present knowledge, and probably never will. It looks like natural laws like gravity are being broken. And that is a problem for some theologians as well as for some scientists, because the biblical picture of God is a consistent God. It rings through the Bible. So, you know, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today and forever. Was it summer and winter, sea time of harvest, sea or not fail? So this consistency of God rings through the Bible. So if God is a consistent God, would he break his own natural laws to perform miracles? And that's one reason why I think many miracles are, in fact, God working in with and through nature. But let's just think about now the resurrection, and does God break his own laws? So let me just take an analogy, and let's imagine you come into this room, and you see someone playing this piano, I'll call it a piano here, sort of electric piano, and you walk behind them, and they're playing without music, they're playing from memory, and you watch that person's fingers on the keys, and you notice that every time that person goes to play the note F, in fact they play F sharp. Now I've forgotten my music I used to know, but I think if he does this repeatedly, this pianist, you can think, he's playing in the key of G major. And the key of G major means that the composer, when he wrote this music, he has what's called a key signature, and that's his rules for playing the music. And it's telling the pianist, or you know, if you're a violinist or something, every time you see this note F on the music, you play F sharp, not just F. And this key signature appears at the front of each line of music. And scientists, this is what scientists do with the universe. We watch for these regularities, these patterns, and we produce, you know, what we call these scientific laws or physical laws. However, let's say you continue watching a pianist, and every so often, he doesn't play an F sharp, he plays an F. Or every so often, he puts in a C sharp or an A flat. And you think, he's put in accidentals, right? These are accidentals on the music score. And because he is the composer, he of course is totally free to do this. But if he's a great composer, he won't do it capriciously. He'll do it because it makes even better music. And I've done these experiments at home. So take a piece of great music and play it on the piano, and then play it without the accidentals. And what you find is, it's a piece of great music, but with the accidentals, it makes it really special. It makes it even better. So, okay, the analogy then is obvious, isn't it? God is the master composer. He set up the way the universe will run. But because he's the master composer, he's not bound by his own laws that he's set up, and he can create accidentals. But because he's a consistent God, he will not do this capriciously. It will always make more sense to have the accidentals rather than less sense. And let's just have a look at how the first disciples described the resurrection. Did they regard the resurrection as something capricious? This is Peter speaking on the day of Pentecost, which was just about 7 weeks after the crucifixion. And what Peter says is, God raised him, that's Jesus, from the dead, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. That's Acts 2:24. So what Peter's saying to his audience, he said, look, if Jesus really was the Son of God, then the resurrection is not incredible, it's inevitable. But if he really was the Son of God, then he could not die. So the resurrection is consistent with a consistent God. So I'll just digress slightly, because as you know, I'm interested in dating things and so on. That's about the Pentecost. It's quite interesting. Pentecost comes from the Greek word 50, and how Pentecost was calculated is described in the Old Testament book of Leviticus. It's sort of vaguely interesting if you're an analytical mind. And that is, what was done, the Passover lamb was slaughtered on the 14th day of Nisan. So Nisan was the first Jewish month of the year. It corresponds to our March, April. And then they would eat the Passover lamb that night. But because the Jews had a sunset to sunset day, that night was then the next Jewish day, so it's Nisan 15. And then the next Jewish day was Nisan 16, and that was a very special day as well, because that is when the first fruits of barley were harvested. And the barley harvest couldn't occur until the priests went out in the fields, they cut the first sheaves of barley, they brought them back to the temple, and they waved them, it's called waving the sheaf. And so the first fruits were given to God, right? First fruits of barley harvest were given to God. And when Paul says of Jesus, Jesus is the first fruits of those who rise from the dead, his audience would have understood this to mean, or have referenced this first fruit barley harvest. And just as when the barley was harvested by the priests and waved in the temple, that enabled the rest of the barley to be harvested. So, you know, when Jesus was resurrected, that enabled other Christians to be resurrected, and his Christian church eventually gathered in. And if you do the sums, then if the crucifixion was on Nisan 14, when the Passover lambs were slain, so Jesus was slain exactly the same time as the first Passover lambs were slain, so Jesus had Passover, then Nisan 16 was actually the day of the resurrection, right? Nisan 14, Friday, Nisan 15, Nisan 16, whatever. And so when Paul talks about the waving the sheaf and linking Christ to this, that the chronology is exact, that Christ was resurrected on the day when the first sheaves of barley were waved in the temple, signifying that the barley could be harvested. So, you know, the chronology fits exactly. Now, why is it called Pentecost? Pentecost was then determined to be 7 weeks after, that's where the seven comes in for the Greek Pente, 7 weeks after Nisan 16. 7 weeks is 7 weeks of 7 days, so it's 49 days. So you think, why 50 days of Pentecost? And that's because the Jews counted inclusively. So we would regard it as 49 days, they would regard it as 50 days because they count both the first day and the last day in 50. So it all works out. And just as an aside, this is really why I'm saying this, there's a number of people, a number of Christians, who say you can't have a Friday crucifixion and a Sunday resurrection because it's not 3 days. And that ignores the way the Jews count, because they counted parts of a day as a day. So when Jesus was crucified Jesus died at about 3 p.m. on the Friday, then that was the first day of his death. And then the whole of Saturday, the second day, you know, from sunset to sunset, And then from sunset on Saturday to when Christ rose, that part of the day was then the third day. So Jesus really did die, really did rise on the third day. And some Christians sort of get this wrong and they say, ah, the crucifixion must have been on Wednesday or Thursday. Anyway, that's an aside, but I thought I slipped it. So coming back to miracles. Most miracles, what we said, I think, are miracles of timing. Alison gave an example yesterday. There's a nice story of, I think it's someone called Mueller who ran an orphanage in Bristol. And it's a wonderful story about, it was run totally by faith. And the money just came in for bills just at the right time. It's a remarkable story. There's a book written about this. So most miracles, I think, are miracles of timing. These happen today. No scientific laws are broken. But resurrection is like an accidental, if you like, on a music score. Or, you know, the walking on water, like an accidental on a music score. I think that's not an adequate analogy for the resurrection. I think the resurrection is so great, it's not like an accidental on a music score, it's like a change of key signature. And you get this in compositions, you've written a certain key, and suddenly the composer changes the key signature for a few bars, and he comes back to the original key signature. So I think the resurrection is like a change of key signature. And maybe, this is very tentative, maybe that is a sort of foretaste of what heaven will be like in our resurrection, that God is going to change the key signature. So we will have resurrected bodies which maybe can go through walls and through doors. That is an aside and very tentative. But you know, I think resurrection, like a change of key, is a really major change, just for a few bars of music, and we come back to life. But maybe that's what will happen in the future. Okay, let me now move on to what I was going to start today's talk, which is about being an academic as a Christian and approaching academic life as a Christian. And in the previous talk, I said we should integrate our academic life with our subject. So when we read the Bible, we should read it with one eye through the eyes of a believer and the other eye through the eyes of a scientist or a linguist or a geographer and so on. Let me just broaden that to say that we just shouldn't compartmentalize our lives at all. So worship is not something we just do on a Sunday. And in the discussion group we had yesterday, Akaya Oklobia, if I pronounce your name correctly, made this point very well. He said, the emails we send, we should do as unto the Lord. The phone calls we make, we should do as unto the Lord. The lectures we give, our undergraduate lectures, we should do as unto the Lord. And so, you know, we just don't compartmentalize our lives. We just do everything as if every day is a Sunday, as it were. We do everything as unto the Lord. I appreciate this is really difficult when we're busy. You get all these emails coming in. I'm really bad at this. I get messages from administrators. And it really sort of, you know, my blood almost starts to boil sometimes because of these crazy things we're asked to do as academics and things, and the way the system sometimes operates. But, you know, we reply as Christians to these things. If we got a whole host of emails to do and everything, why don't we say, you know, first thing in the morning we may say our prayers and then say the next email I'll do unto the Lord, you know, and just live our lives of work as Christians in this sort of way. Another point I'd like to make is each day at work, I think we should try and say something which is cheerful and encouraging to someone else that will brighten their day. And of course, particularly if they're Christians, we should encourage them. We should encourage everyone. And we're really bad at this as a nation. I think we're really bad at encouraging people. If you look at the New Testament, Barnabas means son of encouragement. Barnabas doesn't feature strongly. He never wrote a book, but he encouraged two people who did. He encouraged Paul and Mark. And if you look at the Acts of the Apostles, you'll find that when Paul was converted, he was originally rejected by the Jerusalem church. And Barnabas went to him and accepted him and encouraged him. He then went to the church at Jerusalem and he persuaded them to accept Paul. And because of that, you know, Paul wrote his letters. I mean, if Mark Barnabas hadn't taken those actions, then maybe we wouldn't have the list of Paul. The barn dance last night, after the first barn dance, Joe Martin said, "That's really good." Actually, I suspect his seemed better barn dance than mine. We were all greatly encouraged, and that was really important. And that's really important. And so, you know, we actually have better barn dances after that, maybe. So encouragement is really important. And we should be, you know, we should show the joy that we have as Christians. But my father tells this story, and I'm actually not sure if it's true, but he tells this story that he had to meet the preacher for a church service, and he went to the railway station, and he thought, how am I going to know if this person's a preacher or not, the visiting preacher? So people took the train, and he picked out a person who he thought was a visiting preacher, and said, "Excuse me, are you the preacher tonight?" And the man said, "I'm sorry, I've just got indigestion, that's why I look like this." Right, just moving on to a few different things. So, the surprise of God. The Christian life is a wonderful life because it's a great adventure. And I think God loves to surprise people. I mean, this comes through the Bible. If you just look at... we heard from Alison yesterday. We heard about Abraham and Isaac giving birth to his son. Sorry, Abraham and Sarah giving birth to his son. Giving birth to his son Isaac when they're both very old. Great surprise from God. They could have had Isaac as a son, presumably, when they're much younger. But, you know... It was just deferred, and this huge surprise from God that Isaac came. Or just think of Jesus joining the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and he surprised them by joining them, and then, you know, told them, he expounded the scriptures, and then he sort of waited, and then it was as we were breaking bread. Maybe they then saw the nail marks in his hands as he broke the bread, and he again just surprised them, and then left. So I think, you know, from the Bible, God just loves to surprise people, and we should be open to the surprises of God. And because we spend so much of our time at work, these surprises may happen at work. And so when we're at work, we should be open to the surprise of God. Another point, an obvious point, these are lots of obvious points. We should use our talents. I think God calls you to be humble, but not over humble. All right, God calls you to realism, and so we've all got lots of talent. We've all got different talents, and we should have an honest assessment of our talents, and we should use these talents for God. And the church, the body of Christ, is composed of people of all sorts of different talents. So use your talents to God, your special abilities. If you don't know what your talents are, be a Barnabas. Alright, just encourage those people who are using their talents, because being a Barnabas is very important. But try to use your talents. What I'd like to do now is just to give a few examples of, you know, being an academic and a Christian. A few years ago I had a new Chinese research student start, and the first morning I saw him and I talked about his project, and then after lunch, knock on the door, and he came into my office, and he said, "I am told you believe in God." And I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "But why do you ask?" And he said, "Well, that's amazing, because in China we're taught that no scientist can believe in God. So," he said, "how is that possible?" And I said, "Would it surprise you to know that many scientists believe in God?" And he said, "I'd be greatly surprised." And I said, "Well, I've got this book, it's a book you may know, it's called Real Science, Real Faith, where every chapter is written by a different scientist." And so I happened to have one in my office at work. I said, "Would you like a copy of this book?" And he said, "You would." I said, "Would you read it?" And he said, "You would." So I gave him a copy of this book, which he then read. Now, I tell this story because I think it is important for people at work to know you are a Christian. And I suspect with most people here, that is the case. But I also suspect with some people here, that is probably not the case. And I think it is important Right, we're told not to hide our light under a bushel. A bushel means a basket. It's probably one of these sort of wicker type of baskets. And Jesus is saying, don't take your lamp and cover it with one of these baskets so the light can't escape. So people need to know that you are a Christian. And how do you tell people you're a Christian? And I think this is, you know, really for you to pray about and how to do it best. And I thought about this, you know, years ago at work. How would I tell people I was a Christian? And one thing I thought, and I think, you know, just thinking, one thing I thought of doing was just having a Bible on my desk. So people came and saw this Bible. That may be fine for you. I actually decided against this. I decided that was just a bit, I don't know, too obvious, and it might actually put some people off, right? So you have to be quite careful. So I do have a Bible at work. I keep it in my desk drawer. I people just know I am a Christian at work, but I also have on my bookshelves quite openly some biblical commentaries. And I don't put them there because I thought, well, that biblical commentaries are. I put them there because they're there naturally. So when I do write a few books, not many, and I come in at work at the weekends usually to write these books because it's just, you know, concentrated time rather than being home. And so I naturally have these biblical commentaries on my book, and then sometimes on my desk because I don't clear them away after the weekend. So I think the great thing is to be natural. That's really important. Don't be forced. Lots of people I know have open plan offices, and I heard this story the other day of someone in an open plan office who had been thinking, how can I just let people know I'm a Christian? And then he had this idea, which I think was a good idea. People were having sandwiches at desks at open plan offices, and so he invited his church minister to come in and, you know, sort of have lunch with him. A church minister came in, he wasn't wearing a dog collar or anything, and they just had their sandwiches. And then as they were leaving, he just took this minister, you know, through the room. And he said, oh, by the way, can I just introduce you to... He said, this is the minister of the church I go to. And he just introduced them. And so just very gently, and people knew he went to church, and he was probably a Christian. So, you know, let people know you are a Christian, and think about the best way to do it. But that's an example of someone who did this. Okay, I'd now like to move on to another example. And people have asked me here, but people also ask me at work, how did I come to get involved in writing this Last Supper book? And it's an example, I think, of God being full of surprises. So let me tell you about it, because it's a set of circumstances which, looking back, are rather unusual circumstances. And let me start by saying it is sometimes difficult to know the will of God. I think many people, we talk about knowing the will of God. And when you're trying to make decisions about jobs, I found it really quite difficult. And then when you look back, you can see that, you know, the will of God was happening. And I think sometimes God just wants us to use our common sense. And I'll tell you what I do. It's maybe because I'm a scientist, but when I'm trying to make a decision about whether to accept a job or something, I take a piece of paper and I think about it very carefully, you know, over a day or two. And I write down pros and cons, you know, what's the advantage of taking this job, what's the disadvantage, and I think about it very carefully. And then I throw a bit of paper away and just do my gut feeling. But I need to go through that very objective process first. And I think, you know, God often, if you don't have direct guidance, it's using your common sense to say, this is what I think God is wanting us to do. And that's why, of course, again, there's our common sense. So, okay, how did I come to write my Last Supper book? So I was in Oxford. How did I start getting involved in dating biblical events? And I guess that probably is my biblical talent. It's a strange talent. Not many people are doing this, which is very nice. I can take my time. There's not much competition, which is good. But I think it is important. I think the more you can pin down events in the Bible, in history, the more you improve the historical reliability of the Christian faith. I think it's important for some people, because for some people it's a barrier that, you know... our Christian faith is not some set of fuzzy beliefs. It is based on historical events, like the birth of Christ, his death and resurrection, the more we can pin these down in history, the more we improve the reliability, the historical reliability of the Christian faith. So I think it's not that important, but it is important to do this. So let me tell you, the sequence of events, which looking back is pretty unusual, I think. I was in Oxford. I had a research grant for the interpretation of electron microscope images of crystals with defects in them. So what I was looking for, this is a fairly theoretical project, what I was looking for was someone who would write and do some fairly complex computing, which for those of you who are physicists involves solving the Schrodinger equation for a system of incident electron and electron microscope, incidents on a crystal which had various defects on it. So I advertised for a computing assistant, and I appointed someone called Graham Wallington, who was an astrophysicist who had been doing his PhD for 7 years. All right, I know in Oxford it's possible to go on and on and on. I know most universities is much more sensible. You have a deadline of 4 or 5 years. Anyway, he was in his 7th year as a research student. He had no funding and desperate for funding, and he was an expert, a whiz kid on computers, and so he accepted this job, which he was going to do just to get money, and then in the evening he'd continue writing his thesis. So I appointed him, this expert astrophysicist, as his computing assistant. Shortly afterwards, my younger daughter had a birthday, and one of the presents my father gave to her was a book called Great Men of History. I think today it might be called Great Persons of History. It's then called Great Men of History. And each page was just devoted to a certain historical character. So it had one page for Julius Caesar, one page for Alexander the Great, one page for Christopher Columbus, one page for Jesus Christ. And in the front, it had an index, and the index just listed the people who would be in the book, and it gave their births a date, gave their dates of birth and their dates that they died. And for Jesus, it said, born 4 BC, died AD 30, But for everyone else, it had a date of birth and death. And so my young daughter said to me, Daddy, why is it that Jesus is the only person in this book we don't know when he was born and when he died? And I thought, well, that's a really good question, and didn't have a good answer for her. And then shortly after that, it was Easter time, and I was in church, and Luke's gospel was being read. It was a crucifixion story, and in the version which was being read, and I'd never heard this before, and I was just sitting there in church, it talked about the darkness for 3 hours at noon, and then the words were, for the sun was eclipsed. And that was that particular translation of Luke, and I hadn't come across that before. And so I was sitting there, and I thought, goodness, if the sun was eclipsed at the crucifixion, then we can date the crucifixion. So I thought, I've just appointed this astrophysicist, so I can go and ask him, look up or calculate, retro-calculate solar eclipses. So I went back to see Graham Wallington the next day, and I said, look, Graham, in your spare time, do you think you can look into this really interesting question? And he said, I'm not a Christian. He said, why should I do this? And I said, okay. I said, but it's a really interesting problem. And he said, but I am interested in historical astronomy, which I didn't know. And in fact, he was quite an expert in historical astronomy. And I said, well, look, you don't have to be a Christian to do this, because, Tacitus says that Christ was crucified. It's a historical event. You don't have to believe that. You don't have to believe in Jesus to believe he was crucified. So, could you do this? So he changed his mind, right? Persuades him, changed his mind. The next day he came in with a huge smile on his face, and he said, it's all rubbish. It's all nonsense. And I said, why do you think it's rubbish? Why is it nonsense? He said, it's impossible. And I said, why is it impossible? He said, because the crucifixion is at Passover time. And he said, Passover is full moon time. And he said, at full moon, you can have a lunar eclipse, but you cannot have a solar eclipse. You can only have a solar eclipse at new moon time. And then he sort of did me a sketch of moon and earth and sun. And so then I got interested in this. And so I thought, why is this in Luke's Gospel? So I looked at Luke's Gospel and I spoke to some. I mean, one of the advantages of being in university is that you can contact people in other disciplines. So I actually spoke to some theologians. I said, look, why does Luke say the sun was eclipsed? And they actually didn't know the person, so I'll look into it for you, right? And so I looked into it, and then I also looked into it. It's three Greek words saying the sun was eclipsed. It's only in some Luke manuscripts. It's in, I think, 50% or thereabouts. And the earliest ones don't have this in at all, right? So it's in some and some others. But then more importantly, the Greek words, the sun was eclipsed, the best translation is the sun's light failed. Right, he's not talking about a technical eclipse. I mean, it can refer to that, but the real interpretation is the sun's light failed. So, some version of Luke's Gospel say the sun's light failed, and there's also an apocryphal book which is quite interesting, which talks about this darkness at noon, which puts it down, which actually says it was a dust storm. So, you know, dust came down from the sky and it was a dust storm. So if you're looking for a natural explanation, then it could be a dust storm. It's not a bad natural explanation because there are what are called Kamsing dust storms in this part of the world. And the first one is in March or April, and the first one is the worst. And I've experienced one of these. I was in Kuwait. Don't ask me why I was in Kuwait. I was in Kuwait. And I was walking down the street in Kuwait, and I looked ahead of me, and I just saw this wall of darkness coming down the street. It was an amazing sight, all the darkness coming down the street towards me. And people were rushing into the houses, and I said, what's going on? And there was someone there who, you know, obviously understood English, and he said, dust storm, get inside, get inside. And I wasn't far from my hotel, so I went back to my hotel in Kuwait, which is a modern Sheraton hotel, and you know, they've got these sealed windows and everything. It has a patio thing that's sealed. And this dust storm came, and it was a brilliantly sunny day, and then suddenly it went dark, totally dark. And I had to put the lights on to see in my hotel room. And the sandstorm was so vicious that actually, even though these sliding doors were shut and sealed as they are, sand got in through around the seals. So, you know, if you want a natural explanation for this darkness at noon, there is actually a very good natural explanation, a dust storm. And similarly, gosh, I don't want to get digressed too much, the number of events of the crucifixion mirror a number of events of the Exodus. So you may remember in the Exodus there was darkness the first one. And Exodus actually describes it as darkness which can be felt. Darkness which can be felt. Describes a dust storm very well, darkness which can be felt. But okay, that's a digression. Anyway, the point is that I had now got really interested in the date of the crucifixion. And I knew it was, you know, it's a problem to my daughter. It wasn't a problem, but she could raise it as an issue. And so I got really interested. And that's how I got started. But looking back, it is a rather remarkable sequence of events that I happened to appoint this person. And a computing assistant you wouldn't normally appoint as a rather expert astrophysicist, who was also interested in historical astronomy. And then I got this book, so I knew that the date of the crucifixion was unknown, and then I was sitting in church. A rather unusual version of Luke's Gospel happened to be read out at that service with these words, the sun was eclipsed. Found it wasn't right, but then that got my interest. So be aware of the surprises of God and the way in which God works in these remarkable sort of ways. So just to continue a little from there, let me just explain a bit about what I've been doing in that work, just very briefly. So how do you go about dating the crucifixion? Well, you start by looking for broad clues when Jesus died. And one of the broad clues is given to us by Tacitus. This is one of these really nice external references. It's nice to have a crucifixion. So Tacitus says, Christ had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. So that tells us that at the crucifixion, Tiberius was the emperor and Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea. And these dates are recorded because they were important officials. I should say, you know, it actually is not a surprise that we don't know the dates of birth and death of Jesus, right? Because at that time, only, I mean, Jesus was born a pauper, right? His date would not have been recorded. He died a common criminal, so his date would not have been recorded. The dates of other people crucified were not recorded. So it's not surprising we don't know these dates. But we do know the dates when Caiaphas was high priest. We do know the date, because they're recorded in Jewish literature. We do know the dates when Tiberius was emperor, because that's recorded in Roman literature. And so you can say that Jesus was crucified when these people were all ruling in different ways, and it turns out that's in the period AD 26 to 36. So you say the crucifixion in that period. Then you say that. So you look for other clues, and the Gospels tell us, and all early Christian literature tells us the crucifixion was on a Friday, and the other clue we have is that the crucifixion was at around Passover time. I'm just going to make sure I don't run on. Around Passover time. And Passover time to within a day. So John's Gospel and the synoptics, Matthew, Mark and Luke, appear to disagree on the date of the crucifixion. They don't really disagree, they appear to. So within a day, so either Nisan 14 or Nisan 15. And so you can then ask this sort of well-posed question, in the period AD 26 or 36, when did Nisan 14 or 15 fall on a Friday? And I then went to Brian Bollinger again, who is himself no interest in this, and he reconstructed the Jewish calendar in the 1st century AD. We have no records of the Jewish calendar in the 1st century AD in this time period, AD 26 to 36, so he reconstructed this. Other people tried before, so Isaac Newton had tried before, and he just got it slightly wrong, but only very slightly, because he didn't have the mathematical equations as good as we have now. So you have to take into account the... Okay, I won't bore you, but you have to take into account the fact that the Earth's rate of rotation isn't constant, and Isaac Newton thought it was, right? And because of the tides, the Earth is slowing up all the time. It's tidal friction. And so there are other reasons why it's not quite constant. So, and the computer programs, one of them, were very good. We checked them against over 1,000 ancient and modern observations of the first sighting of the new moon. Right? The first day of the Jewish month is when you first see the crescent new moon in the sky. You can calculate that astronomically. You can wind back the equations and calculate it in the past. And this agreed with over 1,000 observations, both ancient and modern, of sighting of the new moon. And so that's what we did. We published this paper in Nature in 1983. So that's when I first got involved really in this. Called The Date of the Crucifixion. Huge international interest. It was actually on the first front page of the main Chinese newspaper. Mm-hmm. Someone sent me this from China. I mean, you know, it just said, believe it or not, Jesus Christ was crucified on the 3rd of April, 1933. So, a lot of publicity. And interestingly, the editor of Nature at that time was John Maddox, who was then Sir John Maddox, who was a militant atheist. And he didn't know about my paper being published. And he was the overall editor. The physics editor was someone called Philip Campbell, who is now editor of Nature. And he was quite sceptical. He sent my paper, I sent it to Nature because I wanted the science to be verified, or I not, rather than sending it to a theological journal. He sent four referees, which is unusual. I mean, you usually have two referees, and they were also positive. He sent me their comments, which was very kind. I had a bishop refereeing this, the Bishop of Birmingham, someone called Hugh Montefiore at the time, a very eminent astronomer, called David Hughes at Sheffield, who retired a few years ago. There was a chronologist, and who was the fourth person? Oh, another astronomer, right? So, you know, it was well looked at by fire. Well, anyway, so, and Philip, can I just tell you, Philip Campbell had arranged for the front cover of Nature to be a very nice stained glass window just depicting the crucifixion. And apparently when Maddox saw this, he just banned it. He said, we cannot have nature publicising error. But the paper's too far advanced, so the paper got published. And this front cover was hastily replaced by, it was some dreadful front cover. It was done right at the last minute. I mean, this, you know, just a change of front cover. And front cover, which didn't mean anything at all. Pretty bland. Anyway, it got published and a lot of publicity. And I should just say the other thing that we did in the paper. So you can look at all the clues in the Gospels and you can show only one day fits, and that's the 3rd of April, AD 33. The other thing we did was a bit more controversial, and that is that when Paul's talking about the crucifixion of Jesus at Pentecost, and you know the disciples have been accused of being drunk. Look, isn't this wonderful? These disciples are so enthusiastic on the day of Pentecost, they're accused of being drunk, all right? So that's a message to us. And Paul gets up and he says, it's the third hour, right? Peter gets up. It's the third hour because they counted... Although they counted their days from sunset to sunset, they counted their hours of daylight from sunrise. So third hour, sunrise about 6 o'clock in the morning, third hour, 9 o'clock in the morning. And Peter gets up, he said, it's the third hour, these men are not yet drunk. The implication is, you know, the pubs aren't open, the wine bars aren't open, right? It's early morning, they're not drunk. But they're just so enthusiastic, they appear as if they're drunk. So that's a great message to all of us. So when we proclaim Christian faith, sometimes it's good to be so enthusiastic, we appear as if we're drunk. Anyway, so Peter then says, this is the fulfillment of the prophet Joel. Peter actually says, let me explain this to you, this drunkenness, let me explain this to you. This is a fulfillment of the prophet Joel. And you can imagine how a crowd would feel that, you know, Peter's claim, a great prophecy being fulfilled. And then he goes on to quote from the prophet Joel, and he says, talks about the outpouring of the Spirit. But he also says that the sun will return to darkness and the moon to blood before that great and glorious day. And if you interpret Peter at face value, then Peter's saying all this prophecy has recently been fulfilled, not only the outpouring of the Spirit, but the sun being turned to darkness has been fulfilled. And people would realise just 7 weeks after the crucifixion the sun was turned to darkness. That great and glorious day then refers to the resurrection, and Peter says, when everyone who believes on the Lord will be saved. So you know, that again fits with the resurrection, that great and glorious day, when everyone who believes on the name of the Lord will be saved. But then Peter says, the moon will be turned to blood. So the sun will be turned to darkness, and the moon will return to blood before that great and glorious day of the resurrection. What is meant by the moon will turn to blood? Like a blood-red moon is a lunar eclipse. It's well and well documented. In ancient literature of the time, lunar eclipses were described as the moon turned to blood. It was the phrase to describe a lunar eclipse. So I then said to Graham Worthington, extremely tentative, I said, look, were any lunar eclipses visible from Jerusalem in the period AD 36 to 30 at Passover time? There was one and only one, and that was on the 3rd of April, AD 33, the same date as we did. So this was then published in the Nature paper as well, which is really why it caused a lot of... interest around the world. Now, why I'm saying this now as well is to say, as I had a conversation, I think, with someone yesterday, I am convinced that certain events in the world are pre-planned by God. I'm not saying everything is at all. I think certain key events are. This was a normal lunar eclipse. The orbit of the sun and moon might change. It was a normal lunar eclipse. And I think God just pre-planned this before the creation of the universe to happen on the crucifixion. And indeed, the Bible says Jesus Christ, crucified, slain before the foundation of the world. The coming of Jesus was planned before the creation. It was part of the whole creation story, that Jesus would come at a particular time, in a particular place, be crucified at this time. Even the death of Jesus himself, Jesus dying when the first Passover lambs were slain, so that Paul can say, Christ our Passover is sacrificed. So I think these key events were just preordained and pre-planned and put into the whole creation creation plan, if you like, of God. And I think that's quite remarkable. And it's, if you're looking for evidence of God, I actually think it is evidence of God. Let me now move on. Christians experience hostility from others. I think this will happen increasingly, because it's already, as we said, and I was speaking to an American colleague, this is happening quite a lot in American universities at the moment. So although the American public is very Christian, many, many go to church, in American universities at the moment, I was told just yesterday, there is almost a climate of fear amongst people saying they're Christians. And I think that hasn't perhaps reached this country too much yet, but I think it will probably come, and we should be prepared for this. I'm just interested to note that, you know, in England there's a new private university called the College of the Humanities, which A.C. Grayling has set up, and he's a militant atheist. And I was just looking at the staff on this College of Humanities. It's called College of Humanities, but it teaches science as well. Richard Dawkins is on the staff. Lawrence Krauss, who I mentioned yesterday, has been appointed a part-time member of this. I think every member of the staff are atheists, many of them militant atheists. I suspect if I applied to be, you know, on the staff there, I suspect I would not be appointed because I'm a Christian. I may not be right. I have that strong suspicion. So we need to be aware of this. And we need great wisdom in dealing with it. Now, I'd just like to finish by talking about truth, because I think that's really important. It's part of the wisdom we will need for dealing with the militant atheists like Richard Dawkins. Can I just also say that Catherine pointed out to me a very important point yesterday. She said, and it's really true, you know, Dawkins has been really good for us because it makes it much easier to talk about Christianity. And that's really true. So if you go back 20 years, you know, people, you know, dinner parties, you never talked about religion. And now at dinner parties, you can actually talk about religion because you can say, what do you think of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion? Because many people have read it. And so, you know, it's actually helped us to talk about Christianity. So, problems are opportunities, we should always remember. So now let me talk about truth. Truth features so much in the New Testament. So Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The Veritas presentation yesterday, honed in on truth, I noticed that. Pilate, of course, when Jesus said he'd come to present the truth, Pilate said, what is truth? Very famously. So let me tell you a story to start with about truth. After being at Oxford University, I moved to Liverpool University, and the Tate Modern came to Liverpool, and I went there on the first day, and I looked around the Tate Modern, and one thing which really caught my eye, as it did many other people, was something called the oak tree. And the oak tree was a half-full glass of water on a wooden sort of plinth above head height, and it just had the caption, the oak tree. And then underneath, it had an interview of, let's call him the artist, with an interviewer. And what's interesting is, I actually printed off this interview just 2 days ago. It's still on the web. You can go on the web, and you can Google the oak tree, and you can Google the artist who's called Craig Martin, and this interview comes up. And this interview is actually, you know, it's a feature of the exhibition. And let me read you this interview, because it's very instructive. So I'll just describe the exhibit first. It says, the viewer sees a small shelf on the wall, just above head level, on which is placed a plain glass half-filled with water. Down lower, attached to the wall, is a single sheet of paper featuring an interview with the artist about the meaning of the piece, which in itself is a constant part of the installation. So this is the interview. The interviewer says to the artist, could you describe this work? And the artist says, yes, of course. What I've done is to change a glass of water into a full-grown oak tree without altering the accidents of the glass of water. Interviewer, the accidents? Artist, yes, the colour, the whole weight, and the size. The interviewer, do you mean that the glass of water is a symbol of the oak tree? Artist, no, it's not a symbol. I've changed the physical substance of the glass of water into that of an oak tree. Interviewer, and I like this interviewer, it looks like a glass of water. Artist, of course it does. I didn't change its appearance, but it's not a glass of water, it's an oak tree. Interviewer, haven't you simply poured this glass of water on an oak tree? Artist, absolutely not. It is not a glass of water anymore. I have changed the actual substance. It would no longer be accurate to call it a glass of water. One could call it anyone one wished, but that would not alter the fact it is an oak tree. Interviewer, is it difficult to affect the change? Artist, no effort at all, but it took me years of work before I realised I could do it. That's no doubt why you can make it very expensive. Interviewer, when precisely did a glass of water become an oak tree? Artist, when I put water in the glass. Interviewer, does this happen every time you fill a glass with water? Artist, no, of course not. Only when I intend to change it into an oak tree. The intention causes the change. I would say it precipitates the change. Artist, could you teach others to do it? Interviewer, could you teach others to do it? Artist, no, it's not something one can teach. Interviewer, this is the last question. But the oak tree only exists in the mind. Artist, no, the actual oak tree is physically present in the form of a glass of water. So this was in Tate Modern. The next day, I went into Liverpool University, and I went to the staff room at lunchtime, and well, you may not know, but staff rooms at university, I mean, they're meant to be these hotbeds of intellectual discussion. The reality is, the physicists sit together and the English people sit together and the historians sit together. I decided I'd go and sit at a table of social scientists. I'm really sorry, I don't want to attack social scientists. And I took this piece of paper with me, because this piece of paper was also in the local Liverpool paper published this, And so I took this piece of paper and sat down for lunch. And I said, yesterday I went to the opening of the Tate Modern. They also expressed great surprise, this scientist would actually go to an art exhibition. And I told them about the oak tree. And I said to them, look, I said, I've come to join you because I want your advice. I said, it seems to me there's only two explanations of this. I said, either this man is totally mad, is totally deluded, or else, he really believes oak tree to be mad, or else he's a con man. And, of course, he just knows the glass of water, but in order to make money, he's just called an oak tree, he's really a con man. And I said, what is true? And they all looked at each other, and they looked at me, a bit with disdain, and then the most senior professor, he then spoke, and he said, the trouble is, you're a typical scientist. He said, there's just no such thing as absolute truth. He said, all truth is relative. And he said, for you, that really is a glass of water. But for him, it really is an oak tree. And he said, and his opinion is just as valid as your opinion. Okay, so I know we've all come across this before. That's what he said. And I thought, unusually quickly for me, and I said, let's suppose this Christmas time, the Tate Gallery closes for Christmas. And I said, let's suppose, to avoid pipes breaking, the water supply is turned off. And let us suppose the artist finds himself trapped inside the Tate Modern in Liverpool. And he's dying of thirst. And he goes and he looks at this glass of water. I said, do you think he'll still think it's really an oak tree? Or do you think he'll see the truth? It's a glass of water that could save his life. And not one of them spoke. And so I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend social scientists, but it just happened at that table I sat at, right? So, what I want to say is, and of course we all know this is part of postmodernism to say that all truth is relative. But I really was surprised that, it's such a blatant example of the interview, I think, and yet these the, his professors, you know, quite senior people were going along with this. We really need to argue for the importance of objective truth. We need to recognise, of course, that some truth is relative. Of course some truth is relative. But there's objective truth. And there's objective truth in, you know, dropping this coin onto the floor and very likely it's going to fall to the floor. And there's objective truth in Christianity. And I'd just like to finish with an analogy which I found quite helpful, which I call the building of truth. So I think truth is like a building, and let's consider a set of architect's drawings of a building. So think of a set of architect's drawings, then it has side views of a building, which are called elevations. So the elevations may be a side view and a front view and a back view and so on. And then it'll have a view from the top, which is called a plan view, and then there's usually a ground floor and a first floor and a second floor. Each drawing is complete in itself. But we don't have the drawings. It's actually more complex than that. Think of each drawing being broken up into a jigsaw puzzle. The drawings are complete in themselves. Even if the drawings, how they fit together is often quite difficult to see. If you're an architect, you'll see this, but otherwise you have to think in three dimensions. So think of drawings being broken up into a jigsaw puzzle. And what scientists are trying to do is to reconstruct one of these drawings. They're trying to reconstruct the drawing of scientific truth, if you like. Maybe it's a side view of the building. And, you know, we're piecing the pieces together. And occasionally you find a piece is wrongly placed, so you go, you know, reposition it. But scientists are doing a very good job in piecing together this building of truth. But there's another drawing which biblical scholars are trying to reconstruct. And we reconstruct ourselves. You don't need to be a biblical scholar. We read the Bible and we build up a picture of God, and we picture the picture of Jesus and the truth which the Bible is conveying to us and which Jesus conveyed to us. And that says the front view of the building. And these drawings will have common elements. So for example, as we said in my first talk, the Bible mentions creation. Science talks about creation. So there's common elements in these drawings where they join up, common elements in the walls. Now, it seems to me the best way of approaching people like Richard Dawkins is to say to them, which I think is totally true, they see just one view of this building. They see, say, the side view. And for them, the sad thing is that's all they see. The building is just a side view. If you like, they just see the two-dimensional view of the building, a side view. And then people like Richard Dawkins say no other view is possible. We have to say that some biblical scholars see only the front view and say no other view is possible. But for a full picture of this building, we need to look in three dimensions. We need to stand back, walk around, see, you know, the side view and the front view and so on. I don't want to go into the analogy, but you know the buildings are different levels, and so in science you teach simple science to start with. You teach Ohm's law applies, a universal law, V equals IR. When you get a bit more advanced at university, you find out if you've got nanoparticles, Ohm's law doesn't apply. But you don't teach that in schools, and it's somewhat similar with the Bible, that, you know, you teach simple truths first, and then Paul talks about people feeding on milk and not meat as you develop. But the building is complete itself, and for a full view, you need to see everything. I mean, another way of looking at it is to say that, you know, people like Richard Dawkins are looking at the world through one eye, you know, this two-dimensional view, whereas we as Christians say there's another view as well. And I think what Richard Dawkins argues and what people like Lawrence Krauss argue is that scientific view is complete. And I'll go a long way with that. As a scientific view, I think it probably is complete. I think there's no reason to expect that one day we won't have a view of the universe which is complete in terms of mechanisms. But that is to miss out the Christian view of the world, which is really important because it involves relationships which are equally important, of course, and of course the fact that Jesus came to save us. The second view is really important. And so I think that analogy of the building of truth is an analogy which I have found to be really quite useful. And in speaking with people through Dawkins, it's probably best not to get involved about, can the universe arise out of nothing, which is an interesting question which you talked about. In a sense, it's almost best to get not involved in that and just to say, look, there's another view of the world. and it's a view that is a view from the Bible, a view that Jesus came to give. Right, so I'd like to finish now. I'd just like to very quickly go through some conclusions from this talk. So the key thing, firstly, is to integrate your faith with your academic subject. A Christian at work in what you do, so the emails you send, the phone calls you make, and so on. Be a Christian at work then. Try to let people know you're a Christian if it's not known, and do this tactfully at work. Look out for being surprised by God in life in general, but in work because we spend so much time there. Identify your talents and use them. Be prepared for hostility because of your faith. But in treating this, we have to be really wise. I think the Bible talks about us being as harmless as doves and wise as serpents. So, just dealing with hostility in a variety of ways, really wise. So we don't increase this hostility, but we diffuse it. And again, we show our faith. We need to stand up for the truth of the gospel of Christ. We need to stand up for this as fervently as people like Richard Dawkins stand up for the gospel they're preaching. And then finally, last but not least, remember to be a Barnabas. Be encouraging for others. Okay. Thank you very much.